Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson. This is Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. I'd like to thank our technical producer tonight, Mr. Henry May. And, of course, bringing us the Wild World news and adding little tidbits of information throughout the broadcast, Dr. Henry Day.
Good evening, Mr. Batson.
Good evening, Henry. We also want to remind everyone that program is underwritten by Weimer's We Want You Cottages, and that's the home of iKids Fishing. It's a kids fishing website where you can upload pictures of a child any age with their fish and sorted by age or species. It will give millions of kids a chance to compare and show off their fish they have caught. Kids the same age or younger or older. Sure to be a keeper for generations and vacations to come, and one that is free and enjoy it. So We Want You Cottages, our website is WEWANCHU at WeWantYou.com. Way up in beautiful Chautauqua Lake, New York. God's country up there in the western part of New York. So remember that. We Want You Cottages and their great site, iKids Fishing. And they're an underwriter, and they keep Larry Batson's Wild World on the air. Of course, as always, we begin our broadcast with the distinguished, educated, and somewhat mysterious Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Well, thank you. What a nice introduction. And
it was
polite,
nice.
Too.
It was polite. What's going on here?
Well, all kinds of news this week. Good news and bad news, mostly good. We're going to start out with, in the Philippines, a giant golden-spotted monitor lizard that was discovered a few years ago has been determined to be a new species. It's enormous, and it's a beautiful creature.
I heard about that. So it's a monitor lizard, this new lizard they've discovered in the Philippines.
Yeah. Quite impressive.
Go ahead.
You're a big fan of monitors.
Oh, absolutely. So did they give any particulars on how big this particular species grows to?
No, not so far. They still don't know, since it's a new species, exactly a whole lot about it. But it is a beautiful creature.
That's cool. That's what I've always said. We haven't discovered everything on this planet. Look at that, a great big lizard running around in the Philippines.
In this day and age, yep.
And they just find it. Fantastic.
All right, well, let's run off to Deadwood, South Dakota. Now, here's an interesting story. Police are turning to rubber bullets to deter mountain lions from entering the city. Chief Kelly Fuller and his department investigates about 40 lion sightings a year. There were 5 reports of mountain lions on the outskirts of Deadwood in just the last few weeks. Now, what do you think about rubber bullets and mountain lions?
I think it's a bad idea. Because who the marksman's going to shoot these rubber bullets? They can still put out an eye.
Exactly.
And you know what the problem is? It's people feeding deer in their backyards or putting up salt licks.
Yep.
That's exactly what's happened there. Because the mountain lion, believe me, the mountain lion has no reason, has no desire to be around people. Because of all the animals in the wild, the mountain lion is the hardest to find, to observe. I mean, they're just so secretive. And if they're coming into the town, they've got to look why. The reason why this big cat's coming into their community.
That's right.
And so it's either they're feeding the deer, they're putting salt blocks out for the deer. That's it. That's it.
Yep. Okay, well, last week you remember the butterfly migration, the monarchs. Well, here's a little thing in Morrell Inlet in South Carolina. Historic landmark is opening another attraction, a butterfly house featuring hundreds of species. The butterfly house at Brookville Brook Green Gardens in Morrell's, which is kind of near Myrtle Beach, opened last Thursday. So that talk I did about the butterflies last week did some good.
Well, now, will this be open all the time? Because, you know, the butterfly, of course, that's South Carolina. That may not be a seasonal. So
right.
So they may be able to hatch them at any time.
Yeah, and they ship them in from all over the world, so.
Right, yeah.
Butterflies forever.
Yeah,
okay.
It's beautiful, I'll bet.
Okay, now, this one might disturb you a little bit, but...
I don't want to be disturbed.
Well, Anchorage, Alaska.
Yes?
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service continues to salvage, process, and distribute dead eagles via a national eagle repository for conservation effects and Native American tribes' traditional practices. The state has almost half of the population of bald eagles in the country. During the 2008-2009 year, the state contributed 163 salvaged eagles to the repository.
And that's for the Native Americans to take their feathers and use them for their various, which they
correct.
Can legally do, right?
And also, to teach people, and I'm sure some of them are mounted, and, you know, but still, it's still a little disturbing, but...
Well, you know, up there in Alaska, I mean, we have a bald eagle nest just down here from the house, the compound, within a mile. And it's a big deal. I mean, it's like a major tourist mecca. But in Alaska, the eagles are everywhere. They're like pigeons. I mean, it's hard. It is anywhere, especially where your fishing boats, your crab boats, and we've seen it on the Deadliest Catch program on Discovery Channel. And these, you know, where the crab boats are, there'll be dozens and dozens of bald eagles around. And, you know, years ago, what was really funny was there was a turkey farm up in Frankfort, Indiana, and every day an eagle would land in the middle of those turkeys and walk amongst the turkeys. And what's ironic about that is the national bird, which is the bald eagle, of course, Benjamin Franklin, in all his wisdom, at first he wanted to make it the wild turkey.
Right.
So.
And also the raccoon. He wanted the raccoon up there, too.
Well, what did he want the raccoon to do? To be the national animal?
Set on top of the flagpole, yeah, yeah.
To sit on top of the flagpole. Are you just making this up, Henry?
No. Ben Franklin wanted the turkey or the raccoon as the national emblem.
Really? I believe
and he ended up with the eagle.
Well, there you go. All of it's
okay, well, let's run off to Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
I'm there.
Health officials are still trying to determine what led to a stomach flu outbreak that forced the closure of three oyster harvest areas in the past 2 weeks. Several of these oyster farms have been closed to oyster fishing as a precaution. At least 38 cases were tied to the oysters from the three zones, the three special harvesting zones.
How do you say that again, doctor?
Oysters?
Okay. I thought I heard oysters.
Oh, it's probably our PA equipment.
How do you say oyster, Henry May?
I say it like oyster.
There you go. Okay. I'm sorry, doctor. Go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. Quite all right. All right. Norfolk, Virginia. A man who said he fell after stepping in dog feces at the PetSmart store has filed a $1 million federal lawsuit against the company. Apparently he was picking up some animal food and stepped in some dog poop and really injured himself, hit his head, knocked out a couple of teeth.
Oh, my Lord.
PetSmart has denied that that it actually happened, that they're responsible for it.
Go ahead.
You maintained a pet store for many years, won many awards here in the city. Did you ever encounter anything like that before?
Sliding in dog poop?
You had exotic animals.
Oh, you can slide in that just as well. It doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Now, I'll tell you what I have done recently. I've slid in frozen bear poop before, and that's a whole different deal. Hello? Still there? Oh, I think it's just move right along. Our guest is probably hung up.
That's probably the best idea. Okay, now, this one's going to hurt you a little bit, but I have to tell you.
Don't hurt me.
Reno, Nevada.
Yeah.
The State Department of Wildlife said biologists continue to find bighorn sheep that have died of complications of pneumonia. The department said 102 dead sheep have been found over the past 4 months, 74 in the East Humboldt Range and 28 in the Ruby Mountains. The department is concerned that as many as 80% of each herd may die. It's also worried about the survival of the lambs born this spring.
Well, I'm not a doctor, but I'm almost certain that pneumonia is a sign of another problem that, you know, when someone gets sick, the greatest fear is that they'll catch pneumonia. So there must be something going on with these sheep. And pneumonia is just one of I don't always call it side effect, but
right.
There has to be something else going on with the sheep. They'll find it, though.
Yeah, hopefully, because that's a pretty sad situation there.
Very sad.
Because they're very beautiful animals.
Well, you know, they have to look into, is it caused by stress? Is their natural domain being humanized? You know, that's a possibility there, too.
Right.
But if they have plenty of free range, and you know, Mother Nature has ways to take care of things that we don't understand sometimes. So, I mean, look what they did in Australia. They had those beetles that were eating the sugar cane. So someone came up with the idea of importing giant bufo marine toads from South America to eat the beetles. Well, the toads didn't really care for the beetles, and now that's a huge problem in Australia with these giant toads that are very poisonous, and they hop in people's backyards, and their dog comes up and starts chewing on the toad, and the toad secretes this poisonous mucus through their skin, and it kills the pets. So, you know, every time we try and fix something that maybe just let it go its own natural way, sometimes is the best. Not saying that this instance is, but we should take a long, hard look at it.
Well, in most
That's
cases,
my two
you're
cents.
Right.
I know.
All right, well, let's head off to Boston, Massachusetts. Now, this is a nice story.
Oh, good.
A group of 18 North Atlantic right whale mothers and their calves have left the areas for warmer waters off of Florida and the Georgia coast last week to migrate to Cape Cod's shoreline for the summer. The New England Aquarium spokesman, Larry LaCaisse, said the whales are considered the most endangered in the Atlantic Ocean. There are only about 450 of them left in the world.
That's all?
Yeah.
Wow. That's sad.
But the mothers and their babies are heading north, so.
Good.
Spring is in the air.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, we're on to the ladybugs.
What about the ladybugs?
Well, there's, like the butterflies last week, we have a shortage of ladybugs.
Oh, no, we don't.
Well, scientists in a South Dakota lab are on a mission to save the ladybugs from the brink of extinction.
Oh, no, well, they're not getting close to extinction.
Well, here at my house, they're not either, because we see them all winter long.
Absolutely.
There's a big project going on to save the ladybugs. I guess that in parts of the Midwest they've almost completely disappeared. But there's a project called the Lost Ladybug Project, and they're really concerned because, you know, the ladybugs, they dine on crop-damaging pests.
Right.
They keep the pests down on the soybeans, corn, and, you know, and other crops. And they decrease the use of pesticides.
Yeah.
Now, there's three types of ladybugs. There's a nine-spot, they call them C9s, the two-spotted or the traverse ladybugs. Now, the neat thing about all of this is that they're studying them. They're creating habitats so that they can produce more ladybugs, and then they're going to try to reintroduce them out in Kansas and Nebraska, out in that area. And they're asking for people all over the United States to, if they find ladybugs, take pictures, give descriptions or whatever. There's a website, lostladybug.org, where they can send the pictures in and let them know what they're finding. Right. I mean, and the good thing is the ladybugs were, you know, are found in almost all 50 states. So
yeah.
Here's something that everybody can do this weekend. Go out and find a ladybug and take a picture of it.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Is that
the animal news?
One corner of our house, the ladybugs, they winter there every year.
Yeah.
We can always count on them. We can always find them in the house. They're always here.
Yeah, we have the same deal. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's finish up with a story from Great Britain. Britain has declared 210,000 square miles in the Indian Ocean off limits to commercial fishing. The Caicos Islands, which are little 55 tiny little islands, are the world's largest atoll, square in the middle of the Indian Ocean. They hold half of the world's remaining healthy coral reefs, 175,000 breeding bird pairs, and the threatened hawkbill turtles and the green turtles. So they've done a wonderful thing.
Absolutely.
Quite an area.
Good for them. That's fantastic.
That is fantastic.
That's all I have to say about that. That's great news.
Well, that's the animal news for this evening.
Another wonderful job done, Dr.
Well,
Day.
Thank you very much.
Truly gripping, educational, somewhat entertaining. Somewhat irritating sometimes. Not you presenting the news, but the news that you do present. But
that's correct.
But it's just brutal. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, all my great listeners from around the world on Larry Bassett's Wild World, we have a most distinguished guest, a gentleman I've known forever, gosh, close to 30 years, an educator, top-notch educator. He's also an administrator and man, just a great guy. All I can say, we want to thank you for supporting the work that we do with our wildlife education work and going up to the schools up in northern Indiana, up in Warsaw, Indiana. Principal of probably one of the biggest elementary schools in the whole state, and I'm going to tell you, he does a tremendous job. Harrison Elementary in Warsaw, Indiana, Randy Polston. Good evening, Randy.
Hi, Larry. Hey, do that intro again. I forgot to hit the record button. I want to get that in, recorded there.
Well, it'll be in the archives forever.
Thank you very much. That was very nice. And, hey, you know what? You don't have to thank me for bringing you up here. You definitely are one of the best assembly programs we schedule every year. I mean, the kids ask for you to come back and to bring your animals, and it's an educational show. I mean, there's some entertainment there, but it's definitely an educational show, so we appreciate it.
Well, it humbles me, I'll tell you the truth. You know, in the summertime when we're not quite so busy and we run around here taking care of things, wonder why in the heck did I ever get in this line of work, and the day we walk into a school and those kids, you know, we see the kids and the reaction and so forth, and we're reminded, so... It's always been great.
Well, this year, as you share, we're one of the largest schools up here, and you had 780 kids listening to your program that morning, and you could see the looks on their faces. I mean, I took pictures of not only your animals and your program, but I had to turn the camera on the kids' faces, too, because they were definitely in awe.
Well, you have to. I mean, because they're part of the show. I mean, that's what fuels us. I look out and see these kids, you know, with their mouths open and just entranced. And I mean, it's, you know, getting up at 4 in the morning and driving all that way up there, and I'm thinking, man, I'm. And then the minute we walk into that school, it's just like revitalized. It's a tremendous feeling. Nothing like
that's
it.
Neat. That's what the kids do to you.
They do it, and that's why you do what you're doing, and every darn teacher, every good teacher does what they do, is the children.
That's right. That's right. Amen. That's what it's all about.
It's all about the kids, and, you know, that's what's so irritating. I don't know what other states are going through this type of situation. I'm sure they all are in some respects, but these devastating budget crunches and changes that have to be made to the school system. The last thing, in my opinion, that we should touch, it's just unbelievable to me.
Yeah. It's tough times right now. The economy definitely has trickled down to the educational world at this point. But, you know, Warsaw's been blessed ourselves with the budgets that we've been able to establish over the years. So we're not going to be cutting teachers this year. But we are looking at different ways to cut back and help out the whole system as we continue to focus on what's important. You know, no matter what happens, we focus on the kids.
Well, that's right. And thank goodness they have people like you that can basically be the eyes and ears and monitor these situations. And hopefully the higher-ups above you who actually make the final decisions will listen to the principals and the administrators and the teachers.
Yeah.
And
it's definitely a team effort all the way through.
Absolutely. You know, what did Hillary Clinton say? It takes a whole village to raise a child. That, there's so much truth to that.
Yeah, now Hillary took credit for that, but that's actually an African proverb. It does take a village to raise a child, and we're all in this together.
She did steal that, didn't she?
Yeah. See, I said it more politically correct. You know, she took credit for it.
So what's new? Now, you went on this trip. Now, I want to start from the very beginning. You had an exciting trip on the Oregon Trail. But how did this all come about? How did Randy Polston and family get a chance to go on this trip?
Well, I'll tell you, Larry, it actually started in third grade. Believe it or not, I was a little guy at one point in third grade here in Warsaw, and I was a reader. I loved to read stories about the Old West and cowboys and Indians, and my third grade year, I was the top reader, and I was allowed to select a book, any book that I wanted that my teacher had brought to school that day and propped up on the chalkboard. And right there it was, the Golden Book of Cowboys and Indians, and I went right to that book, and I just loved reading about the history of our country, even as a third grader, and all about the Old West and cowboys and Indians. So that love was instilled in me a long time ago by my teachers in elementary school. Well, the Lilly Foundation offers a grant every year for educators. It's called a renewal grant to allow educators to pursue their dreams, and I wanted to follow the Oregon Trail. I wanted to head west. I wanted to walk in the steps that our ancestors had walked. I wanted to see what they saw as they headed to their dream of land in Oregon. And so I wrote the grant and actually tried four times, and on the fourth attempt, so 4 years in a row I continued to write grants, and on the fourth attempt I received the letter last February of 2009, congratulating me and getting this grant to head west. And
wow.
So the plans started. The first thing I did, Larry, I needed some direction myself, and I found a book called Traveling the Oregon Trail. And that book was my map to follow this trail. The trail is 2,100 miles one way, due west.
Wow.
Started in Independence, Missouri, and ended in Oregon City, Oregon. And so upon reading the book prior to our adventure last summer, I had everything, our itinerary, all mapped out. It took the pioneers 4 to 5 months to make it out there in their covered wagons. We plotted out our trip in 10 days. Now, some of those days we only traveled 3 hours, 4 hours, because there were so many sites to stop and see along the way. So we had everything planned out to leave June 27th, last summer, again to head west. I climbed into the Suburban that I rented, and I yelled out, "Westward ho!"
Wow. Now, it started in Independence, Missouri, is that right?
Right. We took off. We stayed in St. Louis the first night, and then we went on over to Independence, Missouri. And the trail actually starts there. In Independence, there is a large field that they have fenced off. They will not allow any construction in this field. This field in Independence, Missouri, was where all the wagon trains gathered together. They picked out their wagon masters. They got the train together. And in this field, you can still see wagon swales. Now, the difference between wagon ruts that are left over and wagon swales, the swales, you can see the depression in the ground and the grass is growing over it. Today, but you can still see that indentation in the ground where the wagon wheels pressed down as they headed west. So in this large field, you can stand there. Imagine many, many years ago when this all started in the 1840s, and all these wagons centered in this field ready to start on an adventure of their lifetime. And that's where we started our own adventure last June.
It had to be terrifying for those first pioneers and settlers. And
well, it was terrifying and exciting all along. The government at that time had offered any American male 60 free acres of land if they headed to Oregon, and if they made it successfully, they would be handed over a deed for 60 acres. Now, only the males could get that. Females had to be married, so if you had a husband and wife together, they could get 120 acres. Unfortunately, some of the history that we read about on this trail was that many families were so excited to get that free land out west that they were allowing their daughters to marry as young as 8 years old just to get another parcel of 60 acres of land.
Man.
But yeah, it was treacherous all along the way. You know, our trip, again, took us 10 days. We stopped, we read, we learned ourselves. You know, some of the things as far as along the trail, they shared with us that just from reading diaries of the pioneers, there are estimates up to around 30,000 people that died along the trail during the from approximately 1840 until the late 1800s. Approximately 15 graves per mile along the trail. Most of the deaths occurred from disease. There were Indian attacks, but most of the deaths occurred from disease and accidents along the way.
So the percentage of people that actually were able to make it to Oregon wasn't that great, was it?
No. When you're looking at 15 graves per mile, you were losing lots and lots of family members.
Of all ages, that's... And I'm sure the weather had to be a big, big consequence when they would go on adventure.
Yeah, one of the things that they tried to do, Larry, is they tried to time their departure in the early spring so that they could get out there across the Blue Mountains of Oregon before those snows started to fall. And so one of the things that was shared with us is that if there was a death along the trail, there wasn't a lot of time for grieving. They would dig a shallow grave. They would bury their loved one right there alongside the trail and then head west again. They had to keep the wagon trains moving as quickly as possible.
That's just unbelievable. People today have no clue.
Oh, absolutely no clue. I mean, the things that I've done with this opportunity, one of my goals was to bring the Oregon Trail back to the kids and adults in Indiana just to share this information. And I've I've given this presentation. It's about an hour, hour and a half. I have a PowerPoint with about 260 photographs from St. Louis all the way to Oregon City. But just the discussion alone, the kids are sit there and their mouths drop open when I share with them. I mean, this was 2,100 miles of walking for these pioneers. The covered wagons basically were the first U-Hauls. I mean, they loaded up every belonging they could get into that wagon, and there was no room to ride, and the only person that would ride in those wagons were infants, newborns, obviously, but if someone had a broken bone and couldn't walk, they would try to make room in a wagon for that. But you walked 2,100 miles, 4 to 5 months, all the way out there.
Unbelievable.
One of the things that the kids get a kick out of that I'll ask every, and I'll ask you, Larry, and anyone else that's on there, two jobs that the children had along the Oregon Trail, two main jobs, do you know what those might have been?
Taking care of the horses.
Good guess.
And collecting firewood.
Well, that's good. That's what everyone would share. Well, but you missed it.
Was there any prizes involved?
Not this
I love
time.
Prizes.
Not tonight. I know you do. The two jobs for the kids. The one of the jobs was actually.
Let's ask what? Dr. Day. What do you think?
All right.
Boy,
see what you think.
What did Dr.
Trying to figure out.
Oh, this ought to be good.
Boy, I don't have any idea, really. If I was a kid on the Oregon Trail, I would be collecting something to eat as I was going along, you know, berries or whatever. I'd be collecting any animal I could find along the trail. But, boy, I don't know. That's what I do. But that's pretty serious stuff for those kids there. I don't know.
Okay.
Okay, we're dumbfounded.
All right, here's the answer.
Okay.
The one job that all the children had to do, they had to take turns, and they always picked a child. They rotated from day to day. The one child had to walk right beside one of the front wheels on the covered wagon, and they would count the rotations of that wheel for the entire day, and they better not lose count, because at the end of the day, they had to share with the wagon master the rotations of the front wheel. Then they had some type of formula that they did their math with in order to figure out how many rotations they went equals X amount of miles. So that's how they figured how far they traveled in a given day.
Oh, my Lord. Well, that makes sense.
Now this, yeah, it does.
Absolutely.
The second job had us all astounded as well. We were getting this information at one of the visitor centers along the Oregon Trail, but the wagon master that was talking to us shared the first job of the children. Then he said, all right, does anybody know what the second job is? Of course, we were all dumbfounded at that point, too. We had shared pretty much what you thought. And the wagon master looked at all of us and said, well, the other very, very important job of the children was each evening they had to take a stick with a rag around the end of it and pick the nose of the oxen.
There you go. Now that's something Henry Day would have enjoyed.
Now see, I should have known that.
You should have come up with that one, man. That's on that note,
the oxen cannot blow out from their nose. Of course, breathing in from their nose all that dust and dirt gathering during the day. So they shared with us that if that job did not get accomplished correctly during the evening, the next day the oxen would suffocate and would die on the spot.
Oh, that's worse than a flat tire, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, with educator Randy Polston and his fantastic adventure on the Oregon Trail, this is Larry Batson's Wild World. This is Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in a few moments. Going to take a short break, and you're listening to Blog Talk Radio. Stay tuned for more with Randy Polston and the Oregon Trail.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Babson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Take me fishing and show me how to drive the boat.
Take me fishing so I can tell you what a great dad you've been.
Take someone you love out on the water and see where the water takes you.
Take me fishing because I miss my boy.
Rediscover the joy of boating and fishing. Get information and get going at takemefishing.org.
Hi, this is Paul McCartney on behalf of Rad. If you're drinking, you can't drive my car or any car. Remember, if you're partying this holiday season, don't drink and drive. Got it? It's just not worth it. Doesn't make sense. Thank you.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Duty, freedom, country, family. They're the values that make America strong and what our armed forces are fighting to defend. While many talk about these ideals, without action, they are just empty words. If you think America's military families deserve more, log on to thanksusa.org. It's a great way to thank our troops and give military families the gift of education. Thanksusa.org. Scholarships for America's military families. You can make a difference.
We're Rascal Flats. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
There are some visitors you'd just rather not see. Like your obnoxious brother-in-law, Louie.
Hey, everybody, we're here. Good to see you. When do we eat?
But then there are some visitors you just can't get enough of. To make your farm or ranch a more attractive place for the visitors you actually want to see, contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office. They can help you build the habitat wildlife loves. But as for Louie, try disconnecting the doorbell. This message brought to you by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and this radio station.
Hi, this is Pat Green. The blood supply is at critically low levels, and you can help. Call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE. That's 1-800-GIVE-LIFE. Schedule your appointment to donate blood. Your donation is critical because every 2 seconds someone in America needs blood. That's accident victims, surgical candidates, and cancer patients, just to name a few. Please donate blood and encourage your friends, family, and neighbors to give too. Please call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to make your appointment. Thank you.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, 1 second, I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Babson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Babson.
Hello, everybody. We've had a great time tonight with Randy Polston, educator, and his trip on the Oregon Trail. We're going to continue that conversation. I want to remind everyone that were underwritten by We Want You Cottages up in beautiful Chautauqua Lake, New York, and his very exciting new addition to his website. It's called iKids Fishing, where kids can actually go to the website and upload pictures of a fish they've caught and compare them with other children that are fishermen and their fish that they've caught all over the world. So it's very exciting, and it's, as they say, sure to be a keeper for generations and vacations to come. And you can reach that, iKids Fishing, at the We Want You Cottages website. It's WEWANCHU at WeWantYou.com. And very exciting. That's way up in Chautauqua Lake in western New York. Also, I remind everybody about our website, where you can read all about and find out about our wildlife education work that we do and also our wild animal rescue. And if you'd like to contribute and support that, you can do that through the website. And it's LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. It's filled with lots of pictures of animals of past and present that we've worked with, and also some pictures from some of the programs we've done with the school children and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I think there might even be a couple things from Johnny Carson when we used to do that many, many moons ago. So that's LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. Of course, join us tonight, Dr. Henry Day. He's been very inspirational tonight.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. But we're all here to hear the tales and stories from his fantastic trip on the Oregon Trail, Randy Polston.
Hi, Larry. Hey. Thanks again.
Well, thank you. This is almost like a big deal, huh?
Oh, big time.
Big time. So you take off on the Oregon Trail, and we've talked about some of the hardships that these people had to go through, but now, let's talk about some of the amazing sights that you saw on this trip.
Oh my gosh, Larry! Where do I begin? You know, the trail itself covered, as we shared, started in Independence, Missouri. It dips down into Kansas a little bit, then heads across Nebraska, Wyoming, Idaho. Once it gets out to Idaho, now basically, I had a gentleman ask me. I was just doing my presentation this afternoon up in North Webster, and a gentleman came up and said, how did the trail get started? How did the pioneers know what direction to go through all these, the prairie and the mountains? And basically, it's Indian hunting trails. And this Oregon Trail was laid out along Indian hunting trails because what the pioneers found out was that that was the flattest and easiest route to go because they just followed what the Indians had already established. And so that was how the trail itself got started. Once it gets up to Idaho, it was right along this area in southern tip of Idaho where there was a split, a branch on the trail. And the Mormons who headed west to go to Salt Lake City would branch off at this point. And then the gold seekers would also branch off at this point and head down to California. But all along the trail, one of the things that I tell the children is that the kids back in that day didn't have their handheld video games or their TVs in the covered wagon to watch their movies and DVDs. So they would get bored at times, and so they would look for land formations and different sites. And we'll start with Nebraska. Throughout Nebraska, there's a land formation that basically is left over from volcanic ash from thousands of years ago, and it's called Courthouse Rock and Jail Rock. It's just two large rock formations that seem to jut up from the ground, and it looks like a huge courthouse and the jail right beside it. So historians have read in the diaries of the pioneers that many of them looked at that formation and said, oh, that looks like a courthouse. That looks like a jail right beside it. And so they would give these land formations these names. And that way, when they wrote in their diaries, that's how they communicated with their loved ones. Many of the families would be split up. Some would decide to head west and get a homestead created out there in Oregon and then let the other family members know to head west. And so they would say, you know, soon you're going to see Courthouse Rock or Jail Rock. And down the road a little bit further still in Nebraska, there's an area called Chimney Rock, and it too is left over from ancient volcanic actions out there. And it looks like a chimney just shooting straight up from the ground. And so, you know, you go along these, you read about them in the history books, and all of a sudden, as we're traveling west, you know, we were off the beaten trail so many miles. We didn't follow the interstate out there. We were on the off roads all the way out, just so that we could see these land formations that the pioneers talked about in their diaries.
So, how did the Suburban do with all of this?
You know what? The Suburban held its own until I backed into a tree at one point. We were at one historical site, and my wife got out to go take a look at something, and I lost sight of her. And there are rattlesnakes everywhere out there. And
really?
I was backing, oh, man. And I was backing the Suburban up to keep an eye on her, and I was watching for her. And crunch, I met a western tree. So.
Let me get this correctly. I'm envisioning this picture at this very moment. You're in the Suburban. Your wife is out amongst the rattlesnakes.
She wanted to go see something. I don't know. I didn't make her get out, so.
Right. But you didn't walk with her and keep the snakes away from her.
Well, I didn't hear any close to the Suburban, so I was all right.
Well, yeah.
She,
and you were everywhere?
She was walking with me in another spot, and of course, there's signs everywhere in every one of these historical sites. You know, beware of the rattlesnake. Just keep your eyes open and eyes and ears open. And this one spot that we were looking at is called Register Cliff. And something else that the pioneers loved to do is that they wanted to chisel their name on the side of cliffs and rocks so that it was left there for family members to see, hey, he made it this far or she made it this far. Mm-hmm. So in Register Cliff, literally this cliff is just covered with names. The government had put some fence up to keep mankind away from the cliff today because we had people ruining it, trying to chisel their names in right beside all the pioneers. So I'm reading all these names, and I'm trying to find one from Indiana, which I did. I was able to find one from Indiana. I'm taking pictures and everything, and Rachel, my wife, is behind me, and all of a sudden she's saying, Randy, I need your help. And I'm so busy reading names that she said, Randy, I need your help. And I finally turned around and I said, what? What's going on? And she goes, there's one right down here by my foot. And I said, one what? She said, a rattlesnake. he's shaking his tail. What do I do? And I said, walk away. He doesn't want you close to him.
Yeah.
So she walked away and he left her alone. So.
Well, I'd heard that the Custer's battlefield, it's the same way.
With the rattlesnakes?
Yes, because I remember my parents went out and saw that. I was there once, too, but they'd gone back a year that I didn't go, and they remarked about that they said there were, but they didn't see any.
Yeah, you always heard them. I heard them, obviously, before we saw them, but literally there were signs all along this trail to keep an eye out for rattlesnakes. And when we were visiting Chimney Rock there in Nebraska that I was telling you about, they won't let you go out right out to it. Number one, they don't want people messing around with the land formation. People are trying to take chips of rock off of it because it's a historical site from the Oregon Trail and things. So they keep you away from it. But number two, the entire field leading out to it is full of rattlesnakes, and we were at another location, and man, this one was just rattling his tail to beat the band, and of course you could hear him before you could see him, obviously, which is a good thing, so.
Right. It sounds like a party to me.
Yeah
I was going to say, there'd be rattlesnakes in the van if you were on the trip.
Oh, absolutely. I'd be picking out the big ones.
He'd have his snake stick with him. I know that for sure.
Oh yeah.
Well, not to change the subject, but I will mention for a moment. My brother-in-law. We were down in Dale Hollow, Tennessee, and he's a big skier, and he's got his big fancy ski boat. Well, I don't do that. I have no interest in that. I just don't see any future in pummeling my body across open water. But so I looked along the shorelines there at Dale Hollow, and I said, man, that looks like a great snake place. Dump me off. So I get into these cliffs, and there's just copperheads everywhere. It was like copperhead heaven. And I'm in there looking at these copperheads, and I'm catching them, you know. And my brother and my wife are in the boat, and my brother-in-law says to my wife, Cheryl, what's he doing? And she goes, he's catching snakes. Well, what's he going to do with them? She says, he probably want to take them home. So then it dawned on him that the snakes have to come into the boat to go back home. He started drinking heavily. Okay, back to the Oregon Trail.
That's good.
Wasn't for him. It was bad. But anyway.
Well, another great site, the halfway point on the trail is halfway through Wyoming. You leave Nebraska, you get into Wyoming, and it's called Independence Rock. Mm-hmm. And basically, if the pioneers could make it to this spot by the 4th of July, they knew they were halfway home, and thus they called it Independence Rock. And it's a huge, wide-open pasture area where it's basically a campsite for the wagons. And right in the middle of this campsite is this gigantic rock. I mean, it looks like a whale coming out of the ground. It's just a gigantic boulder. And we made it out there, and I was talking to the agent that was at the visitor center, and they allow you to go right out to the rock. They've got a path, and they said keep an eye out, obviously, for rattlesnakes, and there were jackrabbits running all over the place. And we made it over to the rock, and he said you can climb up if you want. And so I went up. I just had tennis shoes on, but over on one side of the rock, it's not as steep. So I climbed to the top, and he said, look for autographs up there, too. And sure enough, there were pioneers that had chiseled their names all over the top of this mountain of rock. And again, I found some, like, in the 1930s. There aren't supposed to be there, but that was Independence Rock. And again, that was about halfway out to Oregon City, Oregon. You get into Idaho at this point. They got into a lot of spring water. There's a spot called Soda Springs that the pioneers came across, and that was one of their first tastes of soda water, is what they called it, the bubbling up from the geysers from the ground. And then, you know, on through there, we visited several forts, Fort Bridger, Fort Hall, Fort Boise, that the government had put up, Fort Kearney, for the protection of the pioneers. So that's some of the sites that not only were we able to see, but what our pioneers have written about time and time again in their diaries.
And I think what's important to remember is these sites really probably haven't changed that much since the day that they took this trip.
You know what? And I'm glad you brought that up, Larry, because there was a gentleman by the name of Ezra Meeker, M-E-E-K-E-R. And Ezra first headed west in 1852 to claim his 60 acres out in Oregon. He got out there, and he got his land, and he farmed, and he made his money, and decided at one point, it was right around 1906, so it was about 40, 50 years later, he was going to head east again because he wanted to see what shape the Oregon Trail was in. He wanted to know if the sites were still the same, and as he headed back east, what he saw disturbed him, because he saw portions of the Oregon Trail being plowed under by farmers, setting up settlements on the land of the Oregon Trail. He started seeing government doing construction, tearing up portions of history. So he got back here in the early 1900s, and he went right to the government and talked with them. This gentleman made four trips back and forth on the Oregon Trail just to bring awareness to our country that this is a bit of history. And because of his efforts, the U.S. government then took steps to preserve it all the way out to Oregon City, Oregon. And thus what we see today is really thankful that Ezra Meeker made that decision to bring awareness to it.
It had to be inspirational and almost like a religious experience when you see some of this.
You know, Larry, I love seeing all the sites. What I think excited me the most was reading about it in a book, and boom, right there it was. And then I mentioned the wagon ruts earlier in our show, and the ruts themselves, there's approximately 300 miles of actual wagon ruts still out there on the Oregon Trail that you can stand there in the rut, you can stand there and look, and just, you know, I told my wife, I said, hundreds and hundreds of pioneers were right here at one point. There's a spot in Wyoming that just blew me away. I've got lots of pictures of it. But the wagons went over some sandstone in this portion of Wyoming, and hundreds of wagons along the same part of this trail. Because sometimes along the trail, the wagons would spread way out if it was a dusty area. They didn't want to kick up so much dust and dirt, so they would spread out. But then there was other spots where it was just one long line. And then this area in Wyoming, it was one long line, and they wore down that sandstone so much that there's an actual trail that you can stand right in the spot where the wagon wheel was. And they wore it down from the bottom of the wagon and the wheels itself dragging on the ground. Some of it's so deep. I'm 6'7", and I stood down in one of the trails, and the top of it came up to my chest. That's how deep it was. As far as how much the wagons had worn the land down. And now it's almost fossilized, so it's just, you know, it's hard as rock. So you can stand there and you can just take in the view of, wow, this is what happened so many years ago. This is where they came.
Did you see that those are actually wagons, like a wagon junkyard along this trail?
You know, there at this point, everything's been cleaned up and dug up as far as historians know. At all of the interpretive centers, there are wagons. Some of them look as old as the 1800s that they've tried to preserve. But there's, you know, wagons all along here to commemorate that this is what they look like, the old Conestoga wagon. I did, when I got out to Haines, Oregon, when we crossed the state line, Baker, Oregon was the first small town we got to. And then I have a couple aunts that live in Baker. And they took me over to Haines, Oregon, after I viewed the museum in Baker. And at Haines, Oregon, I was talking to the director of the museum there, and it's called the Eastern Oregon Museum. And I'd like to give her credit. Sharon Warner is her name. And I talked with Sharon and told her what I was doing, and I said, you know, I'm going to bring back all kinds of pictures and information to the kids and people in Indiana about the Oregon Trail, but I'd love to be able to bring a piece of the trail back so that they can hold it in their hands and hold history. Well, it's a museum, and they don't just give things away. And she said, you know, Mr. Folsom, I can appreciate what you're wanting to do here, but these things have been handed down from generation to generation, family to family. She said, is there anything that might be small enough that I could loan you? Well, what we found was she had a display of some ox shoes. Now, the ox bottom of the foot is a cloved hoof, so it's two pieces for each foot. Well, she actually had a set of these ox shoes that had been handed down family to family that traveled the entire Oregon Trail. So she gave me on loan one of the shoes so I could bring back, and the kids have just been delighted to hold history in their hands.
I'll bet. You know, that was a truly tremendous thing that you did.
Well, thank you.
I mean, the opportunity, that just shows you that these grants that are given out to educators, it's money well spent.
Well, thank you. And again, it's all about the history and bringing life to the history process, life to the learning process.
And, you know, that's going to inspire some youngster. Maybe that's going to be their passion. I can remember when I was in school that I wasn't much of a history buff because I don't think it was presented correctly. But, boy, I can see where this would just be a powerful lesson in all the different projects and writing skill projects that can blossom from this.
Yeah, with the technology we have today, I've heard from other teachers that have emailed me and said, thank you for your presentation. My kids are Googling every site that you mentioned. They want to see for themselves.
Is there a site that you recommend, Randy, for our listeners to go to about the Oregon Trail?
Really, you know what? If you type in the Oregon Trail, there are site after site that you can go to. You can see the Independence Rock. You can see Courthouse Rock. But just Google the Oregon Trail, and a world of information is open to you.
Fantastic. Well, we want to thank you for being on tonight. It wasn't too painful, was it?
No, it was fun. I enjoyed it, Larry.
The hour flies by. I also want to thank Henry May for doing such a fine job producing us and taking care of all the technical aspects of the show. And, of course, the presenter of the Wild World News and little tidbits of information, Dr. Henry Day. It's always a pleasure to have him on our program.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back next week, same time, same place, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Blog Talk Radio. This is Larry Batson, and you've been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World. Have a great week, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.